Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I'm the host of the show, and thank you for joining me. Today, I'm joined by a guest who usually only goes by one name. You know, like certain people, certain pop stars like Prince and Elvis are just that famous. They only really go by one name. This is another one of those people. It's Areej. But if you want a full name, Areej Abu Ali, she is the founder of Women in Tech SEO. She's the head of SEO for a paper-based startup, but we'll talk about that later. And one of the all-around nicest people in SEO anyway, and just generally speaking. So we talk about all sorts that's going on in her career, going on in her life, and what kind of got her behind building a great community of women in tech SEO. So dive in and listen to that. Quick bit of housekeeping for you all. If you are a regular listener and looking for the next episode, we've got a little break because Easter's in the way and nobody listens over Easter, I've noticed, since I started this. So the next episode is out on Tuesday, the 26th of April. You might want to drop that date in your diary, lock it in, sign up for the email, block out the morning, because the guest on that date is Mark Ritson. Yes, the man I've been chasing since I launched the podcast. Can I get Ritson on? Yes, I can. So here we go. But before we get into Ritson on the 26th, don't miss this one. Areej can tell us all about the great things that women in tech SEO do and the joys of moving in-house as an SEO versus working for an agency, and why maybe being based in the technical team rather than marketing could be the future of SEO. Anyway, have a listen and let me know what you think on Twitter, where I'm at Andy Jarvis. Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. Today I'm joined by Areej Abu Ali. Areej, give us a wave.
Hey Andy, thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you for being on the podcast. Now, Areej, if you don't know, founded Women in Tech SEO, and he's also the head of SEO at Papier. Now, we're going to talk about both of those things. So let's start with Women in Tech SEO, because it's a fantastic movement that's doing some wonderful things. So tell us, where did the idea come from?
Yeah, I mean, Women in Tech SEO has been around now for almost 3 years. It's going to turn 3 years soon, which is so exciting. And my very, very honest answer is it came out of selfish reasons. Around 3 years ago, I was feeling super demotivated. I didn't know whether I wanted to continue being an SEO. I didn't feel like I had my network or people I can connect with. I always felt it was very difficult for me to go on Twitter and ask questions, for example, and things like that. And so I was like, well, you know, I tried to join a bunch of groups. I tried to do this. I tried to do that. I haven't really found a place where I feel like I belong. So I think it was like a random evening where I was like, you know what? I'm just going to create this Facebook group and let's see what happens from there. And I put out a Twitter post and I said something like, oh, Women in Tech SEO, rejoice. We now have our own space, a judgment-free, safe group where we can kind of, you know, ask any questions we want and help one another. And I think I had like 100 women join that same evening, which was shocking.
So you found a niche where there's a demand there. Because I think, look, SEO previously has had a bit of a diversity problem, right? You know, the industry was started mainly by, you know, men of a certain age who all looked and sounded similar and all had a very similar background. Ish. Now, there's been a lot of work done from what I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years to try and change that. But not always a straight line, but growth really isn't a straight line, right? But I think that what Women in Tech SEO did or is doing came at just the perfect time where women like yourselves were just sort of needing to cluster around each other because of growth had maybe stalled. And I think it needed something to come in and shake it up and go, there's a need for this. We need to keep pushing forward as an industry. So that 100 people joining in one evening must have been like, oh, maybe I've hit onto something here.
Yeah, I think it was specifically the niche of it being technical SEO as well. That kind of, I know there's been tons of stuff that happened before around SEO in general. But I think with technical SEO, unfortunately, like anytime you involve the word technical, there's this idea that, oh no, this is so difficult. There is a lot of barrier to entry. How do we even get started on that? I'm a good SEO, but I don't know the first thing about tech SEO. So there's always like these ideas around it. And I made sure to frame it around it doesn't matter if you're even a tech SEO or not yet. If you have any interest in becoming one, then you're more than welcome to join. And I was, you know, I was doing the usual, which is going to like tons of Brighton SEO talks and the likes and so forth. And back then, the technical SEO stage, as you said, like it always looked exactly the same. It was the same speakers who looked the same way and spoke the same way. And I never saw myself represented. Like I've been doing technical SEO from the very beginning when I started. And it, you know, it always got me thinking, well, I'm never going to be able to get on stage myself and talk about it because I don't see myself represented. So I think it was the fact that it was very specific to tech SEO that probably made it really, really popular.
Yeah. And now, so how big is the organization grown to now? Because you're a few more than 100 women now.
Yeah, we're almost 4,000, I think, which is insane. So we're on Facebook and we're on Slack, and it remains a free community, which it's something that I'm really, really adamant on keeping on, because I think it's really important for like to be inclusive for people from all around the world. So it's global. We've got people, yeah, from everywhere. And I think the Facebook group has a little bit over 3,000, and the Slack one has a little bit over 1,000. So yeah.
Brilliant stuff. And what you've grown into as an organization led to you a couple of weeks ago holding your first conference.
Third
conference.
Yes.
Oh no, this is the second time I've made an absolute mess of this. In the last podcast that I put out, I said to someone, so you're US only, right? And she was like, no. Worldwide. Like, oh, Jarvis, I'm going to shoot my researcher.
No, it's okay. I made a much bigger deal out of this one, probably. And our second one was virtual because of COVID.
Yeah.
But the first one we literally did a week before lockdown. Like, we were so lucky. We managed to just scrape by. And then the next week, lockdown happened. So, yeah.
Do you know, I know you did it as well the week before lockdown, because Newcastle Search was due to start the week after. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the event and who the speakers were, because I think one of them was coming to do Newcastle Search that I was going to. So I know this.
Anyway, no, I'll also tell you why you knew.
Didn't happen.
You gave me really, really good advice the first time around. You probably forgot, but you were speaking in Search Love in October 2019. And you gave me really, really good advice back then, because I was selling tickets for my first conference.
Yeah.
And you were going on about how the whole idea of, you know, putting out a tweet and stuff where we say, oh, less than 50 tickets to go, you know, that type of like marketing. And I was like, oh my God, that's so smart. And I started tweeting things along those lines, and it really worked. And I managed to get my tickets sold. So I always remember that about you.
Yeah. So FOMO, fear of missing out, is an interesting thing. And it's something we've touched on a couple of times in the podcast with a few other guests. And it's an area that over time people are developing more of an interest in. As people understand behavioral economics a bit more, and nudges, as they're called, the debate about should we be using nudges and sort of trying to get people to take an action that we want. Should we be using them in our marketing activity? Now, I'm quite comfortable as long as you're being honest and truthful about things. But it's really interesting how it sort of fires the brain when you're saying, oh, like, you know, here's how many tickets are left. You go, well, I've got to go and do something. So that worked. It helped.
It worked. And you made me think of the whole concept of making sure I have like super early bird standard, like making my ticketing system in that way. And I was really transparent. So like on my, you know, in the Tito integration or whatever, the ticketing platform, I was showing how many tickets are remaining out of how many. And it really, really worked. And, you know, it's that last one, like the standard ones, those are the ones that take the longest to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything before that, it just goes so quickly.
And that's the thing, especially with events. And I don't know how it works virtually when people know that the capacity is slightly different and the pricing works differently. But certainly in person, you look at the event and sometimes it's so far away.
Yes.
There's so many other pressing things between now and this event in nine months' time, right? So showing that actually that ticket count and going down.
Yes.
Don't have to say anything. And I use the example in that Search Love presentation of this isn't new. So years and years and years ago, when you used to have to ring up to book flights, this is what they used to do. They didn't sort of tell you there was only so many seats left. But when you rang up to book a flight, you know, you could say, I want two tickets from Heathrow to JFK, New York. And even if the person was looking at a blank screen of nobody had booked this flight at all, the first thing they would say is, let me check that for you.
Yeah.
And just by using that and typing on the computer, and then, you know, they go, right, so it's just two tickets you need. And they had it scripted. So they never lied, but they just had it scripted so that you would create a doubt in your mind and go, this flight must be busy.
Yeah.
And that would force you to book at the price they gave you rather than haggle down. Because if they went, oh, the place is empty, you'd be haggling on price. You'd be like, oh, yes, there's no need to book. So using those techniques, and this is 30, 40 years old, and it goes on even older than that. So it's...
And it helps now. So with the third one, it was as simple as just bringing up the historical data and saying, our first conference sold out in a month. So, you know, you need to get in there quick. And the third one sold out in like 2 weeks, which was crazy. But it's because people knew like, oh no, we totally missed out the first time around. So we want to make sure we attend this time. It's probably going to sell out just as quick, if not quicker. And so, yeah, but no, I always, always remember that advice from you. Really helped me.
Ah, brilliant. Well, listen, it's nice to know that occasionally some things I say are useful to people. So that's great to know. So this third conference, well, mm-hmm. was it your biggest conference? Because I saw some of the pictures and it looked immense.
Yeah. So to be honest, like I always cap it at 300 max. I think there's just something really intimate about it being, and it makes it really, really special because it makes it much easier, you know, for people to network with one another. Another idea I got from Searchlove as well, because I always liked how it wasn't such a massive, massive crowd. I have a lot of people who are very upset afterwards and say, oh, can't you just fit us in? And I'm like, I'm really sorry. We literally do not have capacity. But yeah, it was around 300 people. And our first one was only around 220. So it was definitely bigger. Our virtual one, of course, was much, much bigger because, yeah, we could allow for that. But yeah, it was, I thought it went really, really well. Huge thanks to the speakers. I always say this, and I think speakers make or break any conference. And you know, when you have brilliant speakers on board, then that's it. Like that's literally all you need to get sign off from attendees and audience to have a really, really good experience.
Yeah. Now, look, I was watching it on Twitter, which is a really obvious thing to say, but obviously it makes no sense sometimes when I say that. I was watching it on Twitter, but I was watching because I know a lot of people who are attending or speaking there, and I was watching it in full and just sort of felt this. I have no involvement in this, but such an overwhelming swell of pride about how the event was just coming to life, the speakers, the vibe that was coming out, you know, the positivity of the tweets that were coming out. It just looked like a great thing. And I was sat there going, I want to be there. But knowing full well, that's not what you're after. But no, it just seemed like such an amazing event. So congratulations on putting it
together. Thank you.
Are you no plans to take over an arena in Brighton, for example, there?
I'm so stressed about putting 300 people together. I cannot even imagine like doing something bigger than that. I definitely want to take it to more than one city though. I have these big ambitious plans of taking it to the US next year somehow. So that we'd start having like a UK edition and US edition. We've had some US folks like literally fly over to attend it, which I love them so much for that. But then at the same time, it's like, no, you know, we have, I'd say minimum 40% of our global members are from the US. So yeah, we definitely have a lot of people over there that we can go to. So yeah, but I think in terms of number, I can definitely see myself kind of keeping it that number because I think it is part of what makes it really, really special.
Yeah. Brilliant. And let's, I was saying earlier, just before we started this, that I saw a brilliant post on LinkedIn over the weekend about what Salesforce have done to celebrate a number of Black women in leadership positions. Mm-hmm. They're all sort of director or VP and above. And it looked like just this amazing event that they put on to celebrate that group of people. I made the mistake. You know, lesson number one of the internet is never go into the comments, right? And I went into the comments and I don't know why I did it because it then ruined my day. And there's a whole bunch of people saying, all right, well, when are you going to celebrate white men? And when are you going to do this? And when are you going to do that? And you're just like, oh man, you're just missing the point entirely. But what it reminded me is that there's a long way to go before we are done with diversity, right? You know, people are like, oh, are we not there yet? It's like, no, we're still in the Stone Age. We haven't even got started. Do you have any, have you had any negativity coming towards you for putting Women in Tech SEO together? But then how have you used that positively to drive things forward?
Yeah, I mean, I always get the, and I expect them by now. I think the first time around when I held the event, I was really shocked by it. But I always get a lot of commentary around how my event is illegal. Because
wow, okay.
And I get like actual like links sent to me, like governmental links about how what I'm holding is illegal because it's a paid event that is excluding like a certain gender. which for a minute there panicked me actually, and I had to go speak to some lawyers to make sure I was, I'm not from the UK, so I have no idea if that would be the case or not. But you know, you have women only gyms and you have women only clubs and you have tons of stuff. So no, my event is not illegal. I have realized that. But I think it's in general like this idea of, unfortunately, like, you know, people feeling excluded, that they are not like a part of this community. And, you know, there's been some feedback that, fine, you want all your speakers to be women, but, you know, why can't we go there and attend? And it's very difficult to kind of explain the dynamics of trying to make this as safe as possible. And that's a lot of feedback I get from my speakers about how comfortable they are sharing their knowledge, knowing that, you know, it's a room full of women, and how important it is for them, which like I prioritize. But yeah, I do think we're still a very, very long time away from any of these problems being solved. When people ask me, oh, how, you know, how do you envision, you know, women in tech SEO becoming a success? For me, it's when it becomes redundant, right? Like when we no longer even need that community or that group, because everyone feels equal and everyone feels like they have a voice and everyone feels like they're fitting in. So, you know, the day that that happens and women in tech SEO is deemed redundant and no longer needed, like that for me is, okay, yep, I've succeeded on this mission here then.
Yeah. And sadly, we're probably a long way off. It's not a this year or next year ambition, yeah, that is it, to make yourself redundant. It's sadly a little yeah, way off just yet.
But, definitely.
Yeah. Look, we'll get that. And I think what gives me joy and hope is that there are people like you just driving the agenda forward. And sometimes it's it can be tiring, can't it? Sometimes when, you know, people are looking to you almost. It's like, well, I don't want to do something about this. Don't worry, Arij will do it. It can be tiring, can't it? Sometimes being the figurehead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I tried my best to kind of, I've created like all of these different hubs, like, you know, speaker hubs and interview hubs and founder hubs and la la la. And I've tried to kind of put these resources where, you know, people can kind of go in and do the job themselves, because it's like, there you go, you know, you've got a list of 500 brilliant speakers, you can just go and make sure you diversify your event yourself. Mm-hmm. But then for whatever reason, it's still so much easier for someone to tweet and say, oh, please tag every woman in SEO who can possibly speak in my event, you know, or I'm struggling to find women in SEO, can someone please let me know like where to find them? And, you know, I find, you know, these types of requests very frustrating, because then you are putting the work on others, where others then need to go out to you and be like, oh, you can go to this and this and this. And unfortunately, what tends to happen as well is a lot of the same people get mentioned. And something I always say, and I'm comfortable saying it out loudly, is I don't want women in tech SEO to become white women in tech SEO. This is a struggle of mine as well, where I need to make sure that it is safe, inclusive, and it welcomes diversity. So I always put the effort to, if I've got an interview hub where, you know, every week I publish a new interview, it cannot always be white women. I need to make sure that I'm, you know, amplifying and giving room and space for women from all around the world, but, you know, women from across like different races and different backgrounds. So that's always a struggle and a challenge of mine as well, is it shouldn't just be about like the gender aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. And I know from hosting the podcast that you have to really sometimes try hard. Unashamedly, I've fallen back on my network and tapped into people I know, people I've worked with, to bring them on, or at least to introduce me to other guests on the show. And when I do that, what's really, really interesting is how much of those people are white men in the late 30s, early 40s. Yeah. And that, you know, that's my network, which I think would be fairly diverse. And I'm quite proud of, you know, of the people I know and how I kind of network in different places. And even then, I do sometimes go through periods where I look back and, you know, just there's lots going on. And you look back and you're like, my last five guests have all looked and sounded the same, like weirdly sounded the same, as if they all went to the same school and grew up in the same square mile.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, how have I fallen back into that? And it's an easy trap to fall into when you're busy, you're doing other things. And you're like, oh, it was a wake up call to me that I need to keep working harder and keep checking that with myself, that we're not just, it's not just white men on the podcast or something like that. And it's, I notice it when I'm doing it. And I think, I like to think, okay, well, I have noticed, so that's useful. At least I'm doing something about it.
Yeah.
But it's an effort that shouldn't be there, because I think sometimes you should be able to see the people there and just go, oh, I want that person, I want this person. But it can be quite difficult to, where am I going with this question? It can be quite difficult to make diversity feel authentic sometimes, I think, where you don't just go, oh, I've had lots of white speakers, let me go and look for a black speaker. I don't want to do that. I don't think anybody wants to do that. So I kind of set a really high bar for speakers to come on the podcast, which is why I was like, Arij is coming on. Yes. That's a really high bar. So to come back to the beginning then, because I've been waffling for a little bit, how do you focus on bringing in sort of racial diversity then into women in tech SEO? Do you find it a struggle, or is it actually the speakers are there hiding in plain sight?
Yeah. So, I mean, from my end, I always make sure everything is fully open. So if someone wants their speaker card on, their founder card on, they want to do an interview and so forth, I keep open forms that literally anyone can fill at any time. So I make sure that, you know, there's always this open call for whatever it is, whether we're doing a podcast or a newsletter or whatever it is, for everyone to kind of put themselves forward and apply to something. So making sure that this aspect is open, where you're not the only person who's having to reach out and blind, like, pick out, because what's going to happen is I'm always going to pick from my network if that's the case. So instead, keeping that open and advertising these forms and these open forms helps bring a lot of people in. And then I tend to ensure at that point that, you know, I diversify and I prioritize who comes in from there. So if I, you know, if I have one black woman fill a form and then four white women, you know, the black woman gets first. I would always prioritize and make sure that, you know, she gets a spot, she's added in and so forth. And I do a lot of my own outreach as well. Like I do reach out to, you know, brilliant black women and women of color within the industry. And I tell them, you know, we've got all of these different initiatives. Would you like to be involved in one of them? And you kind of give them that space of realizing and knowing. I think also partnering up with other communities really helps. So Rejoice, who is brilliant, and she runs Be Digital UK. She's one of my speakers. And we work together to kind of make sure there's going to be a lot of scholarship tickets out there for WTS Fest, specifically my festival, that go to her community. And so, you know, partnering up with other communities who are doing a better job than you are when it comes to diversity is key, because we ended up with beautiful looking audience, you know, very, very diverse. And a lot of it is thanks to her and thanks to her community and thanks to her outreach. So reaching out for help and, you know, going to people who are running other brilliant communities and saying, I want to partner up with you. You know, I have this event happening. You know, are there people from your community who'd like to attend, who'd like to take part? And then having them put the word out as well, you know, just kind of, yeah, partnering up in that way, I think that really, really helps.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. So look, there's a lot of lessons I think people can take from that. And even to put in my own lesson, I think once you start to think about diversity, it becomes really easy. It's when you stop thinking, I think sometimes you just slip back into reaching into my network, whatever. But once you, I reached out to some very new guests, people who probably wouldn't have approached if I wouldn't have noticed how homogenous some of my guests were getting. And just with half an hour's research, half an hour, found some brilliant, amazing guests who are coming up over the next number of weeks. And he was like, is that all the work it took? 30 minutes. Literally 30 minutes was all it took to reach out to people.
And honestly, like, new faces put such an effort. And I know we think that, but new faces put like minimum triple the effort that someone who's used to being on podcasts and webinars and so forth would. Because it's really important for them, right? And it's something that's new for them. And so they would put the time and effort and like preparing for it. And you would end up having a brilliant, brilliant speaker with, you know, great output at the end of it. And I think that's something Brighton SEO do really, really right, which is they always, always, always encourage new faces and new speakers to be on their stage. And that's why the quality of the talks is really, really good, because I remember speaking Brighton SEO for the first time, and I think I spent 9 months prepping for that talk, and so do a lot of other like new faces.
Yeah. One other thing, I know you said you keep your event small and single track, which is great. One of the beauties of Brighton, though, is that they have such a diversity of stages as well, like big ones and little ones and small ones. I know, and I did my first Brighton, I think it was 5 years ago. Having been once or twice before, I did Brighton SEO on one of the auditoriums. So it was a big-ish stage, but I'd probably done presenting for 3 years prior to that. And, you know, 5 years after being at Brighton, I'm keynoting this time on the big stage. And the joy of that they can drop people onto small stages first. Because it is terrifying, right? Being on stage speaking in front of people is terrifying. And there's a lot of imposter syndrome around. So being able to start on a small space, realizing that, actually, this is okay.
Yeah.
Graduating onto a bigger one and a bigger one. That's, I think, a real strength of Brighton, that it can help people graduate through stages onto bigger stages and test what they want to do.
Oh, definitely. I remember I think it was 2019, and me and Luke Corthy,
yeah,
we did Brighton SEO, and it was one of the auditoriums. And then afterwards, we both did MOSCON that same year, and MOSCON is terrifying. And then Kelvin tweeted something like, oh, I knew Luke and Reach before they were famous, like something like that. And it was like, you know, honestly, if I hadn't done Brighton SEO, I would have never, ever like had the courage to even pitch or put myself forward for MOSCON. So yeah, like giving those opportunities are so important.
Yeah, brilliant. No, I really love it. And are you at Brighton this year?
I'm not going to be attending the April one. Definitely the September one, fingers crossed.
Okay, well, I might have to wait till September to see you then. So
yeah,
damn it. That'll be all right. Let's jump from your part-time job, if we want to call it that, Women in Tech SEO, into your full-time job. Mm-hmm. So you've recently, and I say recently in inverted commas, it's probably a year now?
A year,
moved from, you've just moved jobs from Zoopla to Papier, and before that you were agency as well. So I want to kind of, you three very different types of job you've had there. So let's start where you are now with Papier, which is a VC-funded paper products company. Is that the best description of it?
Online e-commerce stationery, probably. Yeah.
So and beautiful stationery, it has to be said as well. I mean, I had a look at the website, I was like, oh, this is great, this is the good stuff, right? It's not just any old stationery, this is the good stuff. So talk us through the challenges of sort of head of SEO there in, I'm assuming, a fairly competitive segment.
Yeah, super competitive and so exciting, to be honest. Like when I joined, I was the only SEO, and I only recently hired in my team, which is so exciting. There's something very challenging and very exciting about being the first SEO to come in. Companies around 5 or 6 years old, you don't have any of the scary legacy issues that you would have joining like a bigger company. And when I joined in the tech team, which is the main reason I applied for the role. I was like, oh my God, finally an SEO role that sits in tech and not in marketing. That was huge for me. And I think it's a huge advantage. And it's something that a lot of other in-house companies really need to consider, because you get so much done when you're sat in tech. But yeah, I found it really exciting because you get to build everything like from the ground up. Like there was no benchmarking, there was no reporting, there was nothing there, and everything needed to kind of be built from scratch. So you kind of come in and you own that space, and then you spend a lot of time kind of raising awareness and education with different stakeholders on why SEO is important and why more investment in organic needs to take place and so forth. So, and yeah, you work with a product you love as well. Like I've been such a stationery freak all my life. So it is really, really nice to be, you know, working on a product where you don't find it boring in any way. Like you actually love what we're doing and what we're selling.
I'm going to have to introduce you to my daughter, because I think you two get along famously. She is also a stationery freak. It makes birthdays really easy. It's like, it's just some nice pens and nice pads of paper, and she's over the moon. She's like, yeah. I'm sure it won't stay that way forever. But let's look at that sitting in tech versus sitting in marketing angle. I think SEO sits in marketing a lot because it helps to deliver a number in sales terms or leads terms, depending on what industry you're in. So it's a marketing channel, right? The same as all the other marketing channels. That does cause problems, as you alluded to, with getting stuff done from the tech team, because you're just that annoyance from marketing asking for things to be done. But if you're sat in technical, not marketing, do you also lose that link with the big strategic picture? Obviously, this is the strategy sessions, and I'm always interested in how you keep a link to what's going on in the company strategy.
Yeah, so I think we're really, really lucky because we're still quite a small team, like fairly. So we have a lot of FaceTime with our CEO, and we have a lot of FaceTime with our CFO, which means that, you know, I get a chance at least once a month to kind of report back on my findings and understand what are some of the main like business objectives and what are the main KPIs, and am I aligning my SEO KPIs with the business KPIs and so forth. It might not be the same if I was working in a much bigger company, for sure. I might miss out on some of that exposure. The other thing is I do still have to be very, very cross-functional, because I have to work very closely with PPC and brand and content and PR in a lot of the different like non-tech SEO channels. But to be honest, it's so much easier being cross-functional with marketing teams because they're really nice in general than it is the other way around when you're sat in marketing and you're trying to be cross-functional with tech. Not that tech isn't nice. I think my team is really nice.
I think you're too late, it's too late. I think you'd already flagged where that was going.
Oh, so no, I hope they don't hear
clip,
this.
Don't worry, we're going to edit this and this will be the clip to go into the promo.
No.
Areej Abu Ali says, marketers, wonderful, tech SEOs, oh, sorry, tech, useless,
oh, no.
Hateful, nasty. So you've done it now. Everyone hates you now. That's it. Women in tech SEO is done because you've said
no
that.
Way, no, no way.
No, I think the point you might be, I think the point you are making, and having worked with technical teams and marketing teams before, is that technical teams have a lot of... very clear deliverables that yes. sit on very clear timeline and become quite tunnel vision based on having to do, because they live in a world where 1 + 1 = 2 a lot of the time, and they have this to do and that to do and a backlog and so on and so forth. A lot of marketing is a little bit more nebulous, if you want to call it that, where this thing might have a little bit more impact, but that one, and if we did this well, and there's a lot more moving things around. So the marketers need to hear what you have to say to bring you into that.
Yeah.
So they can see which bits of the puzzle are going to move around. In the tech team, it's very clear. I have a list of things to do. And once I finish that, I might talk to you. But until I finish that, I'm not talking to you. Is it that sort of approach that you mean, where it can be quite black or white sometimes with technical teams, whereas marketers, it's all shades of gray?
Yeah. And I think also what tends to happen is, once you familiarize yourself with like the different product initiatives that are happening with the tech team, you, instead of you going up to them and being like, here's all the SEO work I need you to do, you just fit your SEO work within their different product initiatives.
Yeah.
And just like that, you know, you went from, oh, there's an SEO initiative that I need you to dedicate time for, to here's all your product initiatives and here's the SEO considerations that need to be added in each. And it makes it so much easier then to get stuff done. But if you're sat outside, you would usually not have as much visibility on these initiatives.
So I had Tom Critchlow on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago maybe, where we talked about his SEO MBA. And
yes, I love it.
Big bulk fan. Of that is around, I hate the phrase soft skills, people skills I talk about rather than soft skills, because soft skills and hard skills immediately devalues them. It's nonsense. People skills. I think what you're saying is that the people skills are equally as important for an SEO as the technical skills, as the content skills, as whatever else. Because if you can't work with the groups, if you can't work in cross-functional teams, if you can't talk to your CEO, everything else is a waste of time. You can be technically brilliant, but if nobody else cares, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that was one of my biggest struggles, the agency side. Like, if you want to talk a little bit about, like, you know, agency versus in-house and so forth, that was definitely my biggest struggle. At the end of the day, you know, you're this external person who's kind of handing over recommendations and so forth. You don't know the first thing about their different initiatives and what they're busy with and what they're doing. It's very, very difficult to ingrain and fit yourself within the work that they're doing. Whereas when you're in-house, you have all of that exposure because, you know, it's right there. It's happening in front of you. We're all one team. We're all trying to achieve the same thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I'm a huge fan of like all of Tom's work, and I've taken that course and I thought it was really, really helpful, especially for in-house folks.
Yeah. So your other in-house role was with Zoopla, which again is another, you only like hyper-competitive spaces. Is that right?
Yeah, Zoopla was like, it's so interesting, the comparison now. We were, you know, talking about, houses for sale in London and how we rank 1.5 versus Rightmove, who rank 1.3. And it was like, it was so, so, so competitive. Like, yeah, very, very.
And that brings its own challenges, but it also, it's also really exciting, isn't it? Because you're kind of like testing yourself in the fire of really competitive SEO in a world where you can test and move things through really quickly, given the volume of traffic and things like that. So it must have been really exciting working there, even if maybe the pressure must have been quite high.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, it's an industry where you've got like two or three top market players and you're one of them. And so how do you close that gap? Like, the whole time you're just thinking of that small, small, small gap, and how do you close it? And, you know, you have two key terms around houses for sale or houses to rent, and then in every single geographical. That's basically all the main stuff they're always going to care about from a business initiative. And then add to that, of course, like a legacy website with a lot of its own technical hurdles that you need to work on. being sat in marketing, and then the marketing team being huge, the tech team being massive. Like, how do you even go around, like, you know, working with one another? So it was really, really competitive, I'd say, and definitely like tons of challenges. Most of my time was spent on, can we please get this thing done? A lot of it was spent on that for sure. Whereas now, like, I have a lot more room to breathe in terms of like the analysis side of thing and more experimentation and so forth, because it's, yeah, we're still really young and the website is fairly new. So we're able to do a lot of that. But a lot of that stuff was very, very difficult to do on the Zoopla side.
I think it's one of the big surprises when I first started working at enterprise level companies in marketing more than anything else, just how awful the tech stack can be.
Yes.
And always with good reason. You know, you go in and you're like, why do you use this website or this thing that is so old, is falling apart at the seams? And, you know, you talk to the CMO and be like, look, here's the report, right? The risks of this, the benefits of this. And
yeah.
It could all go wrong and that'd be the end of my career. So no, it'll stay as it is. And he's just like, right, okay.
Yeah.
But that does cause a whole lot of downstream challenges, doesn't it? To marketing activity, to tech SEO, to pretty much everything.
And you really have to pick your battles at that point, because it's like, I know I'm probably this quarter going to be able to fit in like this one ask or this one initiative. And so I really have to make sure that I prioritize it well. Like, and I really, really, really need to make sure I consider impact versus priority, and I understand like them very and know exactly what to fit in and what's worth fighting for and what's okay to drop. I definitely learned a lot from it in terms of stakeholder management and, you know, working with different, like partners across the business and knowing which battles to fight and which battles to drop. Whereas, yeah, now, because we have a lot more space, it's so much easier to even do something and say, you know what, if it doesn't work, we can just roll it back, which is something I was never, ever, ever able to suggest when I was at Zoopla.
Yeah, brilliant. And did you ever notice the impact of TV and traditional marketing on SEO when you're at Zoopla, whether that was a competitor investing big in some offline stuff or at Zoopla? Did you notice the impacts that had on search and rankings?
Oh, 100%. Like, I think I fully started appreciating and understanding seasonality as well when I first joined Zoopla, and this idea of Boxing Day marketing campaigns that a lot of us and our competitors would go out with, and how that would impact brand search and how that would impact interest in the industry. We had some like newcomers as well popping up who were still very, very young, but they used a lot more traditional marketing than we did for some time, and how that kind of skewed things around. So yeah, definitely not something I'm exposed to at the minute, but definitely during my time at Zoopla, it was a massive caveat.
And then rolling back to your agency days, is that where you first started to develop those people skills? And, you know, the joys of agencies are juggling five clients all at the same time. Is that how you sort of started to develop the people skills from being in an agency first?
Yeah, I mean, I'd never go back to agency side now. But to be honest, I always advise anyone who's starting out in SEO, start an agency side. Like, there's so much to learn. And you get to work with a huge number of different clients across a lot of different industries. And I remember my first few meetings with clients and how terrifying I found those, whether it was at pitch stage or whether it was, you know, sharing recommendation stage. And then over time, you kind of lean into it and you become much, much more comfortable. So yeah, of course, it helps so much, because then you're talking to different people from marketing and tech and so forth. And you're trying your best to be an extension to their team more than anything when you're an agency. And those skills definitely help you so much once you move in house, because you can wear different hats and you can think from the perspective of the PR team, you know, and the brand team and the content team and so forth, because you've spoken with a lot of these different teams, even if you were a little bit on the outside when you were agency side.
Yeah. And you got to work with some amazing people as well, didn't you, when you were in agency side? And does that have an impact on you and your growth as a younger SEO at the time?
Oh, huge. Of course. Like, you learn so much, right? Like, we, you know, there's so much that you can learn from working with awesome people. And you pick up on so much more when you're agency side. I've seen people kind of do the opposite, where they were in-house and then they moved agency. And it's such a struggle for them, because it's like, you know, you're so focused on this one website. And then all of a sudden, you need to juggle like five or more clients in one go. Like, how do you even go about doing that?
I think people think agencies are just this great party nonstop, right? And agencies cultivate that a little bit, you know, their Friday afternoon beers and we've got the dogs in the office and isn't it great and isn't it fun here? But it does kind of mask the look, like, you know, sometimes the phone rings, you get an email ping, yeah. and while you're on the phone to one client, someone else is shouting you that another client yes. wants you, and you're like, oh, yeah. how do I prioritize all of this?
Yeah, when you think of like algorithm updates, for example, oh, there's so much headspace now where you can spend kind of thinking about how has it impacted that one website I'm working on. And, you know, you can analyze the data, you can see what happened to your competitors. And then when that happens on your agency side and you need to somehow report that to like 10 different clients who are working in 10 different industries with, you know, 10 different sets of competitors mm-hmm. and everyone wants an answer first, right? So how do you kind of prioritize that and how do you give them the time and effort? And yeah, it's too stressful, to be honest.
I want to come back because I'm really interested to what you were saying about the joy of being based in the technical team, not in the marketing mm-hmm. team. So two things. This is a marketing podcast. I'm going to ask you a question in a moment about that. And then I'm going to follow it up. I want a top tip off you for SEOs, in-house SEOs. Just mm-hmm. gives me a chance to sing the theme tune. But do you think that SEO's future is not as a marketing discipline? Do you think it is more, or maybe even tech SEO, as a technical area rather than as a marketing discipline as it's been seen as previously? Or is that just your organization? Is it, you know, do you think there's a wider lesson, or is it just it works at your organization because it works?
I think it's a product discipline, to be honest. And I know some people who are brilliant at this and talk a lot about this at the moment. Adam Gent comes to mind, for example. I think I completely see SEOs, technical SEO specifically, being more of an SEO product manager role and being sat in these different product and tech teams based on what the initiatives are, and making sure that they fit in all the SEO considerations and all the SEO recommendations within these specific technical and product initiatives that they're set in. So I definitely foresee that happening. At the same time, you know, I see our content strategists and content executives and so forth with their SEO hat in, just kind of sat there and being on the content and brand side at the same time. That's how I kind of see it evolving. I haven't come across a lot of in-house companies who kind of foresee it that way at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I think a really, really good first step is this idea of adopting SEO within your technical teams.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And that fragmentation of SEO as a discipline into, you know, some of it maybe going technical and some of it going more into, you know, staying within marketing. Mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of a similarity to what happened in web development, where it just sort of, it sat as part of the graphic design team for yes. years when it started, and then slowly started to carve out its own way as it became more strategically important and different disciplines maybe dropped into different yeah. places. So it's an interesting evolution as the industry becomes more mature, isn't it? As an industry, not the people mm-hmm. in it, because there's some hugely immature idiots in the SEO industry as well. Now, do you have a TOPTIP for anyone listening who's thinking, I really want to get into SEO, or I want to be a tech SEO?
Yeah, I think, you know, it might seem very, very overwhelming, but it's really important to kind of like start somewhere. As I mentioned, you know, if you're new to the industry, I definitely advise going agency side, because there's so much more that you can learn while you're sat there. A lot of people give the advice of, you know, starting your own website, which I think is a great idea, because you can do like a lot of different experimentation on there and you can test a lot of different things. Just, you know, joining networks and joining communities, and there's tons of resources out there. Don't be overwhelmed with, oh, I need to make sure I pay for a course, for example, or so forth, when there's tons of free stuff that you can get started on. And don't worry too much initially about like finding your niche, where you go like, oh, you know, this is the one track that I want to focus in and I want to be really good at it. Actually, like the more general you are at the start, the better, because you can get to learn and experiment in all of these different sides before kind of deciding, this is the one thing I'm most interested in, so I want to hone down and learn as much as I can about that one thing.
Yeah, no, brilliant advice. And I think if you're new at this as well, an event like Brighton SEO is perfect. It's yes. free. The April one's not, because the free tickets have gone, but there's a ballot for free tickets. Where you can, as the name, clues in the name, right? You can go for free. So all you need to do is be able to get to Brighton and attend the event. 9-10 stages, tech SEO, content, PR, strategy, all sorts of different stuff. So if you're not quite sure, go and watch a few different things and go, which sounds most interesting? How do I get into this? And then follow the people, follow down that rabbit hole and see where you get to. I think that's, you know, go wide first and then narrow once you know where you're going. That's, yeah, brilliant advice. Brilliant advice, Arish. Tapping you for more advice now. In terms of the books podcasts, resources, newsletters? Where do you go to stay in touch with the industry? What are your recommendations for people?
Yeah, I mean, I always say, and I know a lot of people already follow that, but Alida's SEO FOMO doesn't get any better than that, to be honest. Like, she sends it on a weekly basis, and she puts a lot of like time and effort in it. And she always, always diversifies what she shares, which I absolutely love about her. So that's one of my favorite like weekly newsletters, because you can kind of recap all the main stuff that's been shared. Mm-hmm. She also then holds like Twitter spaces that the week following it, where she discusses some of like the most read pieces in the newsletter with a lot of other SEO folks on there. So that's really, really fun to kind of listen and tune in for. And being in-house, I do really have a lot of appreciation for Tom's SEO MBA newsletter that he sends out, and his course and resources. I learned tons of stuff on there in terms of, you know, strategy and so forth. And then of course, yeah, just a shout out to all the awesome stuff I build on Women in Tech SEO as well. We have our own newsletter, we've got our own podcast, we've got our own community groups. So yeah, there's tons of stuff that can be checked out on there.
Brilliant. Links to all of those in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So wherever you're listening, watching, just click on them. And I'll also link to Tom when he was on the podcast. Yes. Just because, well, I don't know, I'm always happy for more listeners to come and to check out what he had to say. Really interested. Tom's view on the world and on SEO as a discipline. I love listening to him talk about it. It's really interesting and eye-opening, I suppose, from that. So brilliant. My last question is always the same to every guest, which is, what one question do you usually get asked, haven't I asked today?
Ooh, people tend to start with an intro. Tell us a bit about you, Arij. You haven't done that.
No, I always think, well, you know what, your bio's in the show notes. So I was, you know, it's like, I just read your bio out. No, I can find that anywhere else. But let's finish with that, because I always say, okay, well, go and answer the question. Because you have an interesting background. So tell us about that.
Oh, well, I love to talk about how, you know, I moved to the UK 8 years ago, and it does feel like my home now. I'm from Egypt. I studied computer engineering there. And then I felt like I was never going to be a good computer engineer. So unfortunately, I went down the marketing track, which I advise a lot of people to not go ahead and do right away. But I think it's kind of where I found my passion within technical SEO, because then it felt like at least I managed to meet it in the middle a little bit based on my background. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I tend to go into a little bit of detail about when we talk about that.
Now, I have very, very limited knowledge. I have this sort of wonderful Anglo-centric view of the world, right? And sitting here in the UK with my blinkers on, my limited knowledge of Egypt is that the university system is thriving and churning out great graduates, especially in sort of engineering-y, technical, not just computer engineering, but the sort of old-fashioned industrial engineering as well. Is that right? Have I just completely misrepresented?
No, you're completely right. I think we have the best engineers, to be honest, and people are always so surprised, like when they move to other countries, for example, or so forth, and they apply for roles, they become very, very competitive. And our university system is so much more difficult than here, because I did a master's degree here, but my husband, for example, he did his engineering degree back home in Egypt, and then he moved here and he did further studies in engineering. And he was like, whoa, like what we're learning in postgraduate here is what we took in like the first year of uni over there. So it's far more like advanced and much more competitive over there. Very, very challenging, but it ends up producing like very, very strong candidates.
Yeah. Brilliant. And I think it is something I'd maybe hope to do something about over the coming years, is just kind of showcase some more about what happens in different places. Because I complained about this when I did my postgrad, that every bit of reading we got was from the UK, US or Australia. There was one bit from Norway. Was it Norway or Sweden? Anyway, somewhere in the Nordics, right? But 99% of what we were given to read was written in an Australian journal, a US journal, or a British journal. You're like, yeah, that's three countries. There's got to be other people writing about marketing. You know, there's a billion people in India and loads of people in marketing there. Why aren't we getting anything from an Indian journal? And look at the guests on the podcast. You know, US, UK, Ireland, Australian, one. I think that's it.
Yeah,
I've got some work to do, right? It's interesting how we get that Anglo-centric view. It's the worldview we have here, but we can't forget that other places churn out fantastic graduates doing great stuff that we maybe need to tap into a little bit more.
Yeah, 100%. Completely agree. But it's really good to have awareness about that, right? And talk more about it and tap into other people's networks and communities and see, like, who can you meet and who can you get to know more.
Brilliant. Well, look, this is an open call out, right? I'm going to go and do some research after this because I need to try and find more speakers. I'm desperate to try and get someone on from India particularly to talk about marketing, because the different cultures and languages and things make the challenge there really, really interesting. I always find it fascinating in that the UK language is a real, you know, the English language and speaking English is an essential tenet of being British. If you sort of look at what people say Britishness is, and that. But you go to a country like India where I think there's over 200 official languages, maybe more than that, and lots of other languages, even if they're not classed as official, yet everyone is still Indian. So language isn't, and so I'm really fascinated from a marketing perspective. How do you do that when maybe English, you have campaigns have to be in English and Hindi and Punjabi and different, you know, depending on where you're targeting. So that's a challenge for me, is to get a guest to come on and talk about that. But if you're listening and you're from one of the markets, or any market other than the UK, Ireland, Australia and America, get in touch. Would love to have you on to come and talk about how marketing works in your country, because I'm desperate to diversify it a little bit that way. But I will be doing some work too. Anyway, that's enough of me waffling. Areej, thank you very much for your time. It's been really interesting to go through women in tech SEO, your career, and some of the interesting things you've had to say, including the fact that technical teams are really awkward to work with. I'm going to take that and put that out.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed this.
No problem. Thank you for your time.